and stood there singing, not a Cheyenne song. I pushed off, but my boots slipped in the deep snow and I fell, finally satisfied, along with the buffalo, to just hear his song. It was a clear night, the kind that freezes the air in your lungs, with the advantage of nothing standing between your upturned face and the glittering cold of those pinpricks in the endless darkness. The wash of stars constructing the hanging road as it arced toward the camp of the dead. The man had stopped singing and now half turned toward me, speaking from the side of his mouth. "You will stand and see the bad. The dead shall rise, and the blind will see." It was a voice I'd heard before, even though I couldn't exactly place it. "Virgil?" He half turned toward me, his profile sharp, and I could see that it was not Virgil White Buffalo, as he studied me from the corner of one eye. "You are bleeding?" I looked down at the blood saturating the ground around me and the neck and chest of my sheepskin coat. Yep, I think I am." He turned toward me fully and walked easily over the deep snow, kneeling and taking my face in his hands, and I could now see that he had no eyes. The empty sockets looked almost as if they shot through his head like twin telescopes, magnifying the black, infinite space with only a few aberrant sparks of warmth from dying stars. "Good. We can use the humidity." "I tracked the blood, and there you were, under the pile of bodies." I started and looked at the both of them staring holes into me, as if I didn't already have enough extras. I watched my IVs drip and took a sip of my orange juice to gather myself until the quiet in the room became unbearable. "The two of you let me sleep away an entire day?" My undersheriff's voice keened with an edge. "You were shot near the external jugular alongside the sternocleidomastoid muscle in your neck. The doctor said it was a slow bleed, but without the pressure from your coat, you might have bled to death." Uncomfortably ensconced at the Custer Regional Hospital's ICU, I picked at my robe and lifted the neckline to try and examine my bandages. I'd had a look at the results of the wound when they'd cut the sheepskin coat off me as though it were a monstrous scab. My wife and daughter had bought the jacket almost 25 years ago. It was one of the most treasured items in my life, and now it was lying in the bottom of some hospital dumpster. "Why did my arm stop working?"
"Blast effect of the brachial plexus. That's the nerve takeoff for your right arm, kind of like a karate chop." Vic slapped my hand near the IVs.
"Ouch. I hope it hurts. I hope it hurts bad enough that you never do crazy shit like this again. But you and I both know that the only kind of hurt that will do that is a good dose of death."
She stared at me, and I guess she felt a little sorry for the last statement because she added, "Speaking of which, how come you left a round in your gun?"
I glanced at Henry and shrugged, quickly developing the ability to do it with one shoulder.
"We're in Indian country. Always save the last one for yourself."
The Cheyenne Nation nodded,
"Prudent."
I thought about telling them about Virgil and Grace Coolidge, but they thought I was crazy enough, so I let it slide. To be honest, I think I was just worn out from pulling the trigger. I looked back at Vic. "For the sake of the alliterative, Deke's dead?"
"Definitely."
"Too bad. I was really enjoying our conversation, and was looking forward to talking with him some more."
She gestured toward my arm. "And letting him shoot at you again for the privilege?"
"When we spoke, he said he was from Las Vegas."
"Was this a long and wide-reaching conversation?"
"Long enough of one for him to shoot Roberta Payne, and for me to shoot him 7 times.
She shook her head.
"Well, he was from Las Vegas most recently."
"You got a file on him?"
She glanced down at the folder in her lap.
"A large one."
"And Roberta Payne?"
She looked up at me.
"Dead, and it was textbook.
The .22 enters the skull but doesn't have the power to escape and bounces around in there like a mixmaster.
I looked back at the bear. How's Tavis?
He is fine. No damage to any internal organs.
Henry straightened his coat and grimaced.
And Emil Fredrickson wants to drag Deke out from the morgue, prep him up on the nearest snowbank, and use him for target practice.
And you're back?
He grunted and then squinted his eyes.
Spasms. They give me muscle relaxers and a brace. They said to take the medication before it starts really hurting.
Then you should have started taking it around 1967.
I turned back to my undersheriff.
Did you talk to the casino people?
I did. The cocktail waitress, name tag Star, said that Willie was secretive about his personal life, but that there was a woman and maybe some other stuff. Then the casino manager said that this Deke character showed up, and the dynamic changed, and the three of them were in there pretty much every night.
Roberta was never alone?
Never as far as they knew.
I thought about it. Deke said that he had taken Roberta from Willie. They all had to stay somewhere.
The bear leaned back in his chair and glanced at Vic.
I am assuming you obtained an address for the now-deceased croupier, Willie?
Yeah, he's got, or should I say had, a crummy little house with an attic apartment.
You have an address?
I do. I started to pull the covers away. Then what are we waiting for? The Cheyenne Nation placed a hand on my good arm.
There are four very large armed South Dakota highway patrolmen outside the door who are charged with the responsibility of keeping you here until you have spoken with Special Agent Pivik of the Division of Criminal Investigation.
Bruce Pivik held a wide and long reputation in Western law enforcement from his days as a fraud investigator with the South Dakota Attorney General's office. Meticulous and unrelenting, Bruce could boast of having taken down a lieutenant governor, a prosecuting attorney, and a mob boss who had attempted to launder money through an illegal cattle processing plant. I had sat in on one of Pivik's intense debriefings and swore that before I ever had to sit through another, I would gladly pound eightpenny nails into my head.
I glanced toward the door and scratched where the IV went into my arm.
How big are the troopers?
Not as big as you, but they outnumber us, and I think they can call for more if need be.
Vic smiled. Your hospital reputation precedes you.
Hell.
I sat back against my pillows and studied the two of them. All right, then read me the Deke report. Vic flipped open the folder and then held her hand out, palm up in expectation of the two bits.
I'll get you later.
I looked around. Where are my pants, anyway? She raised an eyebrow, and the tarnished gold glistened. That's $3.50 you owe me. She looked down and began reading. Deke Big Daddy Delgados is originally from San Diego, California, with a long list of run-ins, run-outs, and run-downs with the law. He did a 7-spot in High Desert State Prison for kicking a guy's head in a bar fight in Inglewood. While inside, it seems he got all giddy with the AWSFB. She glanced at Henry. That would be Aryan White Supremacy Founding Brotherhood. Or as my Fed buddies over in gangs and bikers like to call them, assholes with shit for brains. He nodded.
Catchy.
Delgados continued perfecting his craft in Susanville, where he supposedly killed another inmate and had a hand in shanking a guard. Through overcrowding, they let him out, and Big Daddy got himself a brand new bag in Vegas, where he falsified just about everything about himself down to his DNA and got a license with the Gaming Commission to push cards. She looked up. Now, here's the funny part. Deke had a condo, a brand new Corvette, a powerboat, a winter home in Puerto Vallarta. She shook her head. Either this scumbag's stacking the deck or he's got a little something on the side, right? I sat my empty juice cup on the tray.
He intimated to me he was a hitman. Not exactly somebody you find on Craigslist.
Vic put a finger in to hold her place and closed the folder. She goes missing for 3 months and suddenly turns up 2 hours away? She shook her head. You think he was stupid enough to just keep siphoning money out of Roberta's account until you showed up?
He said he figured that I would be the one. I think he was counting on it.
Henry poured more juice into my plastic cup and drank it.
And why shoot her in front of you?
just happened that way. I think she'd become a liability. She certainly didn't know what was coming. Henry nodded again.
She went to extraordinary lengths to stay with him.
He was a hitman. And if I was making a guess, and this is a guess, mind you, I'm betting he told her he'd kill everybody she knew if she tried to escape. The door to my room opened slowly, and a smiling man with a gray mustache peered around it. Seeing he wasn't disturbing anything, he entered, carrying a large stack of file folders.
"Walter, I thought we had an agreement. You can kill as many people as you like in Wyoming, but not here in South Dakota."
"Hi, Bruce." I watched as he pulled up a chair and sat by my bed. "Anyway, he tried to kill me first." He tapped the stack of papers with a forefinger.
"Is that how I should start the formal report?"
"You bet." He glanced at Henry.
"Mr. Bear?"
"Mr. Pivik."
He smiled at Vic.
"Have we met?"
My undersheriff turned on her most ingratiating Mediterranean smile.
"Moretti. Victoria Moretti."
He carefully took her hand and actually kissed it.
"Ah, you're Italian?"
"Udine, the Friuli Venezia Giulia region." He smiled and then smoothed his mustache and stared at the stack of papers in his lap.
"Walter, this is going to take a while."
"Bruce, I'd love to help you, but my neck hurts, and my head hurts, and I can feel a high-octane nap coming on." He watched me, his mustache twitching under his nose.
"I just spoke with the head nurse, and she said now would be an opportune time to speak with you."
I sighed and faked a yawn. He stood.
"I'll go speak with her again and arrange a more convenient time."
As he went out, I gave him a little wave and looked at a door to my right. "Where does that one go?" Vic made a face and then covered it with her hand. The bear, figuring our odds, looked toward it.
"An adjacent room, which connects to a short hallway leading to the fire escape."
I nodded.
"Now the big question."
Vic spoke through her fingers.
"Who hired him?"
I smiled at her. "Where are my pants?" Lead, South Dakota, is pronounced as is the verb, not as the malleable heavy metal. Once home to one of the most productive gold mines in the Western Hemisphere, Lead now leads the area in twisting, straight-up-and-down, kiss-your-own-butt roads, currently covered with a foot or so of snow. The address we had for Willie was half a duplex jammed into a hillside leading up to the city proper. There were side streets and a frontage road that ran parallel with Main, but even though it had stopped snowing for a bit, they were so choked with the stuff that there wasn't anywhere to park. Vic slipped the bullet in behind a covered Cadillac with Nevada plates and turned off the ignition as I reached back with my good arm and ruffled dog's ears. "Must be the place." I slipped off my seatbelt shoulder harness, which was killing me anyway, pulled an emergency blanket from under the seat, and draped it over my shoulders. Vic glanced at my outfit.
"What?
We're really going to do a forced entry into a place with you looking like that?"
"Like what?"
"A fluorescent homeless person." I adjusted the optic orange blanket. "It's all I've got until I can go shopping, all right?"
"You also don't have a weapon."
"Hop out and I'll get my standby." I flipped down the center console with my good arm, opened it, and pulled out the holstered Colt Walker.
"You're kidding."
I palmed it in my hand.
"Well, until the SDDCI gives me mine back, this one will have to do."
I slung the vintage holster over my left shoulder, and we started slogging around the house, tramping a path toward the steps in the foot-deep snow. Henry took the lead with me following, and Vic bringing up the rear.
"You know, we could go by the National Guard and get an anti-tank gun that we could tow around on the back of your truck. That way we could just set up out there in the street and lob shells in on people."
I ignored her and followed the bear up the steps to the first landing, where we changed direction and found ourselves standing at a peeling glass panel door with tinfoil taped over the window. The Cheyenne Nation drew the frightening knife that he always carried from the small of his back, the one with the stag handle and turquoise bear paw inset in the bone, and pointed at the foil with the blade.
"In my experience, this is rarely a good sign."
"I agree." I reached out to check the door and was unsurprised that it was locked.
"Kick it?" Henry, always the thinking man's felon, slid the blade of the knife between the door and the jamb, popping the bolt and gently swinging the door wide. I could have done that if I had had a knife. He and Vic ignored me as they looked inside. There was a large room with an efficiency kitchen, which looked as if it had been assembled from appliances cannibalized from an RV, with a hallway where there were a couple of closed doors, I figured a bedroom and a bath. The bear was about to enter when a tan and white pit bull appeared at the other side of the kitchen. "You first." He turned to look at me and probably would have responded except for being interrupted by the low, guttural growl emitting from the dog just before it launched itself toward us. The Cheyenne Nation quickly slammed the door as we listened to the pit bull clawing and barking. He finally turned and looked at me. "Any other bright ideas?" "You still have those muscle relaxers?" We sat in my truck and waited about 20 minutes. I'd bought a container of hamburger at the convenience store at the bottom of the hill and had inserted one pill in each of 2 meatballs that I had made. Henry had climbed the stairs and had quickly tossed one of the balls onto the kitchen floor of the apartment. Not wanting to overdose the dog, I'd kept the other in reserve. The rest of the burger, dog consumed in a second or less. "You think that did it?" The bear nodded.
"Considering it is approximately a quarter of my weight, I would say yes."
Making sure I had the extra meatball safely ensconced in a paper cup in my shirt pocket, I pushed open the door of the truck, which was covered in a blanket of snow that was handy in keeping us out of sight of the myriad South Dakota law enforcement that was likely out prowling the Black Hills in search of us. Quietly, we made our way up the stairwell again and paused at the door where Vic pulled her Glock. She ignored the look I gave her. "Fuck you, I'm not getting bit by Michael Vick in there." Henry looked back at the two of us and then turned the knob, pushing the door open about 4 inches. We listened, but there was no sound. Carefully, he pushed it open a little farther and then stuck his head in, an act of bravery of which I was not so sure I was capable. He continued inside and we followed. The kitchen was as we'd left it, but the meatball was gone.
He ate it.
We all entered, and I shut the door behind us. "Come on." I could see a room in the front where an old table lamp without a shade sitting on a cardboard box had been left on. There was a plastic chair, one of those mass-produced ones that everyone bought from Kmart, beside the box, and a small flat-screen TV and DVD player, which were on the floor, along with a stack of homemade discs with dates written on them. Nothing else. Vic opened the door to our right, Glock first, and closed it behind her. Henry and I looked at each other, but after a moment, there was a flush. Seconds later, the door opened and she shrugged. "Bathroom, sorry, had to go." Henry peeled off to the only other room in the place, what I assumed was the bedroom, as Vic kneeled, picked up one of the discs, and inserted it into the player. "Let's see what's on."
"Walter."
I turned and walked over to the doorway where the bear lingered. The pit bull, thankfully still breathing, was lying next to the bed. I stooped beside what was a she and ran my hand over her side, and her eyes flickered, but nothing more. Other than the dog, there was a broken-down mattress and bedspring, yellowed sheets, a thin blanket, and lumpy pillows. I straightened up and noticed that there were ankle manacles lying with their ends open, secured to eyelet bolts in the floor at all 4 corners of the bed, along with another plastic chair pulled up to a card table with a Canon video camera sitting on a short tripod. Oh, boy. The bear took a few more steps in and kicked at a box on the floor. "What's that?" He pulled back a flap and peered in.
"You do not want to know."
Vic appeared in the doorway with all of the DVDs in her hand, a strange cell phone, and a disgusted look on her face. "Bad?"
"Worse than bad."
She shuffled through them. "The ones dated within the last week especially. They are all Roberta Payne. Willie was an amateur in comparison to Delgados." Her face came up.
"Can we go kill them again, please?"
"We can petition Emil. I'm betting he'd be up for that. At the moment, however, they stay in the morgue."
"Maybe so, but Delgados is still getting texts."
The bear and I joined her at the door. 5 minutes ago, somebody asked him if the job was done. "Text them back. I watched as she pushed a button and waited. Need to meet. She typed in the message with her thumbs, and it buzzed in her hands immediately. She looked at it. It's mystery guest number one, and he's asking if she's dead. Tell him yes. Need to talk. She typed it in. Looks like the area code is 702. The Cheyenne Nation was the first to come up with it. Las Vegas. Of course, that does not mean he is physically in Las Vegas. The phone buzzed again, and Vic read the message. Is the sheriff dead? She looked at me. Who the fuck in Las Vegas wants you dead besides the dead guy? I don't know. I felt the stubble on my face. Tell him yes. She typed it. We waited. And after a few seconds, it buzzed. You're sure? I'm sure. She typed, and we waited. He says you're lying. Almost immediately, it buzzed again, and Vic read, Like your Indian friend, Deke never used contractions when messaging. Well, hell. The phone buzzed, and she read, Sheriff? The phone buzzed again. You're a very durable individual. We need to meet. Vic typed, and the response came back. That would not be to my advantage. Are the other women safe? Vic read the response. I'm not concerned with the women. This has to stop. Vic typed and then read, Not necessarily. Ever heard of Asociación Punto Muerto? We all looked at each other. Nope. Vic looked up from the phone, a sickly smile on her face, and read the final text. He says, You will. Chapter 12. We got you a computer and a girlfriend. Henry laid the pit bull next to Dougherty's desk on the dog bed we had purchased. What's wrong with her? Vic put the computer, the cell phone, and the collection of discs on a stack of cardboard boxes. She's got a substance abuse problem. She glanced around at the subterranean confines of the Campbell County Sheriff's Department. Where's the dick? Dougherty was still looking at the dog as he spoke. He hasn't gotten back from Evanston yet. The sheriff came down and told me that he expected him around noon. I nodded. Good to know. He studied the bandage on my neck. What happened to you? Got too close to a buffalo. I gestured toward Henry. Him too. Remind me to never go to South Dakota with you guys. I moved to Galliano's pizza box and put it with about 20 others on top of a nearby shelf and sat in the chair opposite him. You guys must be single-handedly keeping the pizza joints and Gillette in business. I pointed at the computer and discs. That stuff is from the dead guy. He adjusted a folder under his arm. What dead guy? The one who had Roberta Payne. The woman from the Flying J, you found her? We did. I glanced at Henry and Vic, finally dropping my eyes to my lap. She's dead. His shoulders slumped, and he seemed to fall back into the chair, even though he didn't physically move. My God! I'm afraid so. Deke Big Daddy Delgados killed her. Who is Deke Big Daddy Delgados? Henry grunted. One of the dead guys. It is complicated. Nothing on Linda Schaffer? Not yet. I took a deep breath and explained, telling him about Deadwood, Custer State Park, and most of what had taken place at the state game lodge. Evidently he was a hired killer, among other things. I leaned forward. First, I need you to find out who with the Las Vegas number the last text on that cell phone came from, then crack the computer open and get as much information out of it as you can. Dougherty nodded. Will do. I gestured toward the file under his arm. Got anything for us, Troop? He sat forward and petted the dog, even going so far as to put his face down near to hers. He straightened her ear, and she sighed. Match made in heaven. Almost nothing. Vic leaned against the chain-link divider that kept the Campbell County files from making a break for it. Almost. He sat back and handed the file to her. I found the last reports that Gerald Holman didn't file. I interrupted. Where did you find those? He tapped a handle on one of the drawers in the desk. Locked up in here. My undersheriff opened the folder. Holman did another series of interviews in Erosa. So what's the big deal? The patrolman returned to petting the dog.
Look at the date.
She glanced at the report.
Yeah, so?
It's the day he killed himself. Her eyes returned to the file.
Oh.
Dougherty stopped petting the dog, but left his hand on her head.
How do you do an entire afternoon of interviews and then check into the Wrangler Motel and blow your brains out?
Vic handed me the folder.
More important, what do you find out in those interviews that leads you to do it?
Inconclusive, the file simply read that Holman had made stops at Dirty Shirley's, the 16 Tons Bar, and another location identified as undisclosed in or near Arosa. I looked up at the group. What other location is there, undisclosed or otherwise, in or near the town of Arosa?
Vic posited. Private home?
I thought about it. There's an elementary school and a post office. Henry studied me. Nothing else in the immediate vicinity?
No.
He smiled. This should make things easier. Vic's cell phone rang, and she pulled it out, looking at it and then to me.
What? It's your daughter.
I didn't say anything.
The pregnant one.
They all looked at me.
You answer. Chicken shit.
She held the phone up to her ear. Hello? She nodded her head.
Yeah, well, he's around here somewhere.
She listened again.
Right.
She listened some more, and I could hear the edges of my daughter's voice traveling through the airwaves from the city of brotherly love.
Yeah, he told me that.
She was silent for a moment.
It is a case.
I glanced at the Cheyenne Nation and then cleared my throat and held a hand out for the phone. Vic shot eye torpedoes at me and continued to speak, glancing at the bear.
Yeah, he's around too, helping your dad.
There was another longer pause.
I'll tell him.
She pulled the phone from her ear and looked at it.
And a see you later alligator to you too.
What? I slumped in my chair. Please tell me she hasn't had the baby. She deposited the phone into her other hand and pointed at me with it.
No, but they are inducing her tomorrow.
And there are 3 tickets for the noon flight to Philadelphia at the Gillette Airport for you, Jan Standing Bear, and me, and I was informed, and I quote, that if we were not on that flight, then we could all kiss goodbye any thoughts of ever seeing the grandchild within our collective lifetimes. Give me the phone. She did, but I handed it back to her. Could you dial it for me, please? She did, without comment, and gave it back to me. It barely rang once, and my very angry daughter was on the line.
Chicken shit?
Boy, howdy.
Daddy, I want you on that plane at noon.
Katie.
I'm not kidding.
I took a deep breath like I always did when facing total annihilation. I know. It's just that there are some details that I'm going to have to take care of.
For who? A guy you never met who killed himself? Some women who've been missing for months now?
Well, there have been some developments.
I don't care. I, your only child, am about to have a baby who is likely to be your...